Hi, and welcome to this episode of Mediterranean Imaginaries. I'm your host, Alan Magaranov, and today we have our first guest, who is not myself. Anna, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Anna Ulrika Andersen, and I am an architectural historian and filmmaker. So I'm originally from Norway, but I've lived abroad for a number of years.
And just to remind everyone else, I'm a doctoral student at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, studying the Mediterranean diet, human flourishing, and art practice. Now, the channel is named Mediterranean Imaginaries, and today we're going a little east of the Mediterranean, technically the Balkans. We're going to Montenegro. Technically not on the list of the Mediterranean countries, but close enough. It's just separated from the heel of Italy by the Adriatic Sea. Is that right, Anna?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I'm wondering about this idea of the Mediterranean and the definition, I think, of the Mediterranean, if that kind of encompasses all of the countries just surrounding the Mediterranean Sea, or if you were maybe talking about something more specific and than that when you say Mediterranean.
No, I mean that's a great point. I think the Wikipedia page for Mediterranean would probably not include Montenegro, but for today, we're gonna go ahead and consider it as a part of the Mediterranean,
Yeah.
just because I feel like some of the research you've been doing in Montenegro, I don't know, speaks to what this channel is all about. Can you tell us what you have done in Montenegro and how you ended up there?
Yeah, I mean, I think ooh, where do I start? I think with the this site in Montenegro, which is a village called Igalo, which is located at the north by the ocean, just bordering Croatia. This village has been known for many years for its rehabilitation facilities and treatment, especially due to a specific mud that you can find in the area and some mineral contents in the water that has healing benefits or
Tell us a little bit about how that works. Have you ever participated in sort of this mud bath? Sorry, I don't know the
sure
proper term.
yeah no definitely. So the there they have a so basically there's a rehabilitation facility and institute that's kind of based in Igalo and that has been based there since the late 40s. And in kind of former Yugoslavia, many people would go to this area of the country to receive treatment, and that will be for multiple kind of conditions, everything from asthma to heart conditions to rheumatic illness, and receive treatment in this area, which would consist of a range of active and passive treatments. Some of the active treatments would be physiotherapy or going for walks in the area, whereas some of the passive treatments, which I think is more linked to the actual natural resources of the area, would be the, as you said, the kind of mud baths or the mud wraps. And then also there will be baths in this water that has high mineral contents. And I became interested in this site when I learned that the Norwegian government has been sending patients living with particularly rheumatic illnesses to this institute for a prolonged period of times to undergo treatments. So about 4 weeks, and patients will go and stay there. And this has been going on since the late mid-70s.
Wow, and would it be incorrect to call this a spa? Is this sort of like laying on the beach drinking cocktail, getting a mud bath experience, or
I
am I wrong?
think I think it might be a bit incorrect to call it a spa. I think it's definitely in the later years, it draws upon a lot of the things that we would consider a spa. And also, like the past 20 years, the spa culture, as far as I've read about it, has kind of changed in Western culture. Like the spa has become a different site, I think, for many of us. But this idea of the rehabilitation institute that you saw in the former Yugoslavia, and I think there are very similar treatment facilities in former Soviets as well, is that going to these places, you were kind of quite often sent, like by the government. You were kind of prescribed by your doctor that quite often not only you would go, but like your whole family. So if a child in the family had asthma, then the whole family would kind of be sent to these places. So I think it's much maybe better to consider this in terms of part of the welfare system, part, or especially in the Norwegian context, but part of the idea of work and how going to these places would kind of make you more fit to work
Oh,
when
that's
you
fascinating.
return. Yeah.
That's a very different way of looking at like healthcare. And
Because I think, for example, like in the US, as far as I understood it, this kind of approach to mineral baths or mud wraps, that has more to do with the spa, which is much more like it's private, it's expensive, people go there in very different kind of, you're not sent kind of by your employer to go to the spa.
that's
Most,
true.
yeah.
For about 10 years, I held my birthday at a spa in back when I lived in New York City. And yeah, it was sort of a treat, it was sort of like, we had a lot of food. We obviously went to the sauna and pool and hit each other with leaves. This was like a different experience I sense from what happens in Montenegro. Can you explain like some of the differences?
Yeah, I think what you're describing now to me, that sounds a lot more like the sauna culture in Scandinavia, which is and I think probably even more in Finland than in Norway, that kind of like going to a sauna is this like social event. I mean, in smaller places, a lot of politics is actually, done in saunas. At least I have examples of that from Norway. So I don't know this. And it must be said though that so in my PhD, I kind of looked at some of these themes that I'm also trying to explore with this project in Montenegro. But I'm also starting off with an interest for this place that I'm hoping to develop into a larger project. So I think where I'm at the moment is that I'm really like I'm trying to tackle exactly what you're kind of asking now. This, what kind of place is it? How do people inhabit this institute? How do they find it meaningful? How do they talk about it? How do they? What are the representations of that space? Which I think to me as an architectural historian and filmmaker really intrigues me. But I think it's a really good question to ask in terms of like what are the where's pleasure in this, and where is kind of like treatment itself, like receiving treatment for a chronic health issue. It's also, especially when you have like these active and passive treatments, it's a lot of work. Like you, I don't know if that's the correct word, but it takes a lot of dedication. And the research that has kind of looked at the benefits of this from medical perspective has underscored that like the patient's own efforts are the key to success.
So you
So
bring
it's,
up
yeah.
you brought up your PhD.
Yes.
Now, when I met you, you were a visiting student at Harvard, and you were doing this Montenegro project, this sort of this film project, essentially, right? But your PhD was not based in Montenegro. Is that right? What was your PhD on?
So that's correct. So my PhD, it looked at the window in the life and work of a Norwegian architectural theorist called Christian Norberg Schultz. And Christian Norberg Schultz, he was born in 1926 and died in 2000. So he lived kind of in that area of the 20th century. And he's mainly known for bringing phenomenology, and especially the phenomenology of Martin Heidegger, into architectural theory and architectural discussion. So, especially taking Heidegger's understanding of being in the world, and connection to place, understanding of dwelling. I won't go too deep into Heidegger perhaps just now, but
Thank you.
basically taking that philosophical framework and asking kind of what should architects do to design so people find their experience more meaningful, that allows for dwelling is kind of what he's saying. And one of the things he's quite critical towards is then the modern architecture, at least kind of later on in this authorship, the period that I've been looking at, is he's critical of the way that modern architecture looks for kind of universal answers to design questions. So suggesting that there's one way of designing, and if you just do that everywhere, then that's good architecture. And then he's suggesting instead that the architect needs to consider the specific of place, the spirit of the
Okay.
place in the design
And
process.
so how does this all lead to windows? What does it mean
Okay,
to
yeah.
study windows? Like right now I'm in a cubicle, I have no windows surrounding me, so I'm a little out of touch. Help us out here.
Yeah, so Norberg Schultz, he just writes about the window in his phenomenological approach to architecture. And
Can you
when
also
you, yeah.
explain what that means to do a phenomenological approach to architecture? I mean, it makes sense to me in the social sciences, phenomenology, it could be sort of a more like storytelling, portraiture, expressing like through text, perhaps the processes of research. But I don't understand what phenomenology, how that works in architecture.
Yeah, I think it's if I could come up with read a quote here. There's the definition of phenomenology from Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, where they said that philosophy is quite the study of structures of consciousness as experienced from the first person point of view. Which in this I read that. Kind of understanding the way that we make sense of our external world, and how that knowledge comes to us through experience, through first person point of view.
I see.
Yeah, and in terms of architecture, then is kind of understanding the things around us, the structures that we surround ourselves with, understanding how they interact with, engage with our consciousness, or how we make sense of them. But also very important here is like the first person point of view, like the experience. Like Norbert Scholl says, you have to really be in a place, understand the place, see the place, experience the place, to
So I assume you surrounded yourself with a lot of windows for many years. Like, how did you know which windows to study, how many windows, where? And
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, you keep mentioning this first person point of view.
Yeah.
Are you saying this is sort of like autobiographical, or is this, or are you distancing yourself, because I tend to approach things very autobiographically, but I know your background is in journalism, so you're kind of trained to have more of like an objective, quote unquote, approach to studying things. So I'm curious, like, what's it like to study windows through this first person point of view and experientially?
Yeah, I think so one of the things that made me really curious of the window in the work of Norbert Scholl was this film that I discovered from 1992, a documentary about his life and work, and the opening scene is of him by a window, looking out of a window of a train. And through a voiceover, he's saying that, many years ago I did the journey on the train. I've been to Italy for a year, and I was returning to Norway and approaching, kind of crossing over into Norway, over the border. He describes being struck immediately, like this kind of like experience, first-hand experience, personal point of view of just understanding that the place, like the woods of Norway, was part of his identity. And what really intrigued me about that is that obviously that he was, describing a moment where his thinking happened, which to me was quite interesting, because when you look at these thinkers for so long and you read what they've written, and suddenly you get this description of a very specific moment and a place where he suddenly, discovered that, this is part of me.
That's fascinating. That reminds me a bit of my sort of research into the Mediterranean diet, which didn't really begin until I found those archives of the researchers filming themselves, filming each other, and with this voiceover narration. It's really interesting to sort of get into the heads of the people you're studying and sort of kind of follow them, right? Is that so? Would you what's archival? Is it like an archival project, or did you do a little bit of like?
Oh yeah, I mean it's very much based on the archive and archival findings. That's kind of how I've been trained as an architectural historian and art historian. But then I think what happens in my research is that I embark on a journey in Norbert Scholl's footsteps to Italy, to kind of understand how he, in his exploration of place, keeps kind of having a few places that he keeps comparing. And one of them is like Norway versus Italy. This keeps coming back in throughout his authorship.
Cold and hot.
Kind of, yeah, and that's definitely one of the things he brings up is both the light and the temperature, and on these journeys, it ended up being two journeys where I traveled by train from Norway to Italy, and on both of these journeys, I kept a journal, and I think I was quite like struck of kind of about my own experience of following in the footsteps of Norbert Scholl's. I experienced, feeling that it was kind of like, I don't know, like these uncomfortable feelings of getting too close or like following someone, and there, that made me kind of go and look at other like artists doing reenactments. I know as well, like you've
That's how we met.
done reenactments.
Yes, you've helped me film many reenactments, right? And it's fascinating how when you do a reenactment, you sort of learn more about you don't just do the reenactment for, the product, but you also do it to learn more about what that moment means to you, or what else could have happened, or sort of reenactments are fascinating, and I've been using them, but
But I wonder, I mean, do you, but do, in the kind of reactions that you've been doing or planning, do you ever feel these like an uncomfortable feeling so that you're like overstepping some boundaries, like because I
I'm not
wonder
sure.
if we're different. I wonder if we're like a bit different
I'm
here.
not sure if this makes me sound bad, but absolutely not. No, I mean, I think I don't know. I feel like if we're talking about reenactment specifically, it's more about me than anyone else, and I don't really ever feel a sense like an ethical dilemma with studying myself, if that makes sense, because I kind of always treat myself as an archive because I find it difficult to study myself in real time. So what ends up happening is I, film myself or write all these papers, etc., and then time passes and eventually I find them and I'm like, oh, who was this person? And I don't feel like I'm trespassing on my past self. I'm not sure if you can relate to that at all, but that's where I stand on ethics.
Yeah, no, I think that's, and maybe that's like one of the differences in the, I don't know, I'm wondering if since I kind of like followed one person for such a long time, like I started looking into his work in my bachelor's degree, like undergraduate student, and then I did my master thesis about him, and then like years and years of PhD work, and I'm still looking at his authorship, and I'm wondering if that plays, and also the kind of archival material that exists about I found receipts of which hotel he'd stayed in, which room he'd stayed in, what he drank, and which
And
is
you,
brilliant material for a reenactment if it wasn't for the fact that this specific hotel was under, like, it was being renovated when I visited Italy, and I couldn't find the exact room or stay at a hotel. But I think that was like one of the moments where I started kind of like questioning what it means to follow. And I, at the same time, I believe quite strongly, that the, especially as an historian, I think what you're describing about your own work is a bit different, but I think as a historian, you're writing a narrative, you're constructing something about the past, and you're definitely kind of from your own point of view, your own position, but it really matters what kind of narrative you create about individuals or about groups of people as well.
I mean, you bring up one really important point, which is you were successful in actually going to Italy, whereas my project is mostly about my attempts to travel to the Mediterranean. So, full disclosure to anyone listening, this channel is called Mediterranean Imaginaries, and that comes from the fact that it's purely the public sort of imagination of what the Mediterranean is, and especially myself, I haven't been to Italy, at least not since studying abroad in college, and that's a very different but important piece of like my life. But I think yeah, if I had perhaps made it to Italy, I wonder if some of these ethical questions would have come up for me, because I've faced a lot of bureaucracy here, sort of as part of my studies. And one way I found around it is creating these different characters, these people who are sort of not me. I think I have six by now, and sort of constructing this narrative through character studies rather than just treating it as a, autobiographical work like I used to. I'm not sure if you can relate to that at all. Like, have you ever made a character or considered yourself a character?
good question. I think I haven't. Well, one thing I wanted to say is that I found the essay form, both in writing and in film, really fruitful in terms of like tackling these things, because the essay form, it brings in a range of references and anecdotes, so you can kind of come in your writing or the filmmaking, you could bring up this, quotes and really rigorous archival research, but then it has the personal point of view, personal perspective, and then the this really nice way of allowing the author or filmmaker to kind of like straddle facts and fiction. Which is my sentence, someone else said that, but I really like that, the idea of being able to, maybe that's something you're saying now, being able to bring in fiction to whatever you're doing. I haven't really, I mean I for I had like a section of my thesis that I where I considered kind of going in more into fiction or making that a lot more blurry, what's facts and fiction. In the end, I found that because I wanted to make an argument that the essay form could be extremely useful and helpful for architectural historians. And I think in order to kind of make that argument where I was at that point, it was more helpful for me to stick to kind of my own experience and anecdotes that took place. And then again, like this archival research or things that came up in interviews or during site visits or
I'm
visiting
intrigued by
buildings.
this essay form you mentioned because often we talk about sort of this critical media approach to research or multimodal approach to research, and it feels like perhaps we sideline like the idea of like the essay. Just because everybody's so used to, I guess, writing the dissertation, they just just get away from text as much as possible. Which, in my case, it was numbers. In your case, it was interesting because I can't believe someone having to argue for the essay. But I guess that's an architectural thing, isn't it? That's more of like a. Perhaps essays are not
Yeah, I also think that, which I learned during my time at Harvard, that the essay in US academia in the educational system has a completely different definition and meaning than an essay, as we call it in Norway, for example, or this essay tradition that kind of starts with Montaigne and that you can see in theorists such as, Walter Benjamin and Adorno also wrote extensively on wrote about the essay and its potential for kind of its critical potential. Because if I understand the American educational system correctly, then an essay could be, you write it like a term essay, like for every
Like a paper,
A
yeah.
paper, yeah. Whereas this essay form, and especially how it's influenced the essay film genre, is a lot more fluid and flexible. And there's a brilliant book called Essayism by Brian Dillon,
Mm.
who in a such a great way just goes through like all of the definitions of what the essay is and what it's doing, and how it's in a very kind of eloquent way manages to kind of like take you on this like really strange journey through personal experiences and other people's work, and kind of reframes the work in a way that slowly says something about a larger societal concern in a way, which I think it's slightly different from what we learn as undergraduate students to kind of write an essay for
Yeah, I
that.
mean, I was told, I mean, my Spanish isn't very good at all, but I've been told that in South America, you know, the word essay, it sort of means just like try it out, like try something, like just like,
Yeah,
you know.
trial, attempt.
Yeah, it's not really meant to be like a definitive thing. It's more like this, like, give it a try, approach to. Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, I mean, I didn't expect to talk so much about essays
No, me neither.
With a
Sorry.
filmmaker slash, you know, archival researcher, architectural researcher, but we're running out of time. So I'm wondering, is there anything, you know, that you wanted to mention before we go?
I think what kind of summarizes things for me is that all of this work just made me really curious as to why people travel to Italy first. And then, I mean, talking to you and having the conversations that we had, broadening that to the larger Mediterranean area, in the case of Montenegro, is a very, as I mentioned, specific reason for traveling to those areas. But what I've kind of discovered as I was following Christian Nobik-Schulz is a great deal of stories about Scandinavians or Norwegians who travel to Italy and the Mediterranean for health reasons. And that's something that kind of intrigued me. Where it's not just about tourism, or it's not just about this kind of grand tour, it's an educational tour of, you know, the aristocracy sending their young men to kind of have an education. But
William James, I think, is an example. Yeah.
I mean, Goethe is another good example of a traveler to Italy. So I think what really excites me about the work that you're doing with the Mediterranean diet is looking at why these men, I understand they were men.
Yeah,
many,
mostly
many,
men with
most
their wives,
men.
Yeah.
But why these people traveled where they traveled, and how they kind of constructed and created a narrative out of that. I think that's really exciting to me.
Right. And I could tell you that in my failed attempt to, you know, to reach the Mediterranean, again, I found sort of what we discussed, like, you know, these reenactments, these character studies, this, you know, filming yourself, is actually in and of itself is sort of like a cure. So like, if we're talking about mental health or chronic pain, I found that to be sort of like this play cure, you know, this, filmmaking and filming yourself. And that is a healing approach to research, I found, even though I haven't actually made it to the Mediterranean.
Yeah, but I think it's fun to, I mean, in your work, the way that you then conduct these journeys through your filmmaking and reenactment in different ways. I mean, that's in itself is a very valuable, you know, journey or way of traveling, which I think it's interesting. And especially as you say, like how just bringing your own position and your own struggles with bureaucracy and funding applications into your own narrative, because it plays a huge role in the kind of research that you end up writing. You know, if you go or you don't go, or what kind of access you have, when you have access, how you have access, that's an important part of it.
Okay. And before we go, just tell us what's next for you. What's currently, what are you looking to do next?
So I'm currently a visiting scholar at Vanderbilt, at the German department here in Nashville. So I'm working on a book manuscript deriving from my PhD. I'm also planning a screening of my films as part of a series or a larger event called Following Thinkers. So it's me and another filmmaker that use film as a way of approaching like thinkers that came before, and we both kind of follow these thinkers in their footsteps. And that will happen in Oslo in January, so that's exciting. So let's see where all of this fun research will take us. Maybe we'll all meet up in Italy not too long, or Montenegro.
Yeah, or Boston, you know,
or
helping
Boston.
Me, helping me film something.
I'm always happy to come back.
Thank you, Anna. It's been great having you. And if it makes sense, you know, you're always welcome back to express more, you know, of what's been going on with you in the future.
Yeah, thanks.